Requiem by Vandana Singh, narrated by Karen Chilton.
The thought of the letter lying on her desk in the untidy apartment was like a little time bomb ticking in her mind. Varsha told Chester about it, between the steamed mussels and the fish course. "So I'm going to Alaska for spring break," she ended. "But what about Atlanta?" He had been holding her hand in that ostentatious way he had whenever they were in a restaurant known to be a white purist hangout. He let go of it, looking hurt. The seafood place was a hole in the wall with a clientele that clustered around the TV screen and yelled epithets during football games. The aug-reel entertainment was of poor quality, floating sea captains and naked ladies mostly. But the food was fantastic. Chester liked to live on the edge, take her to places like this, challenge the status quo. She pulled down her augs to look at him in the world. The blue eyes, the little cut on his cheek, the slight pout of his lips, a tendril of graying brown hair sticking damply to his forehead from the steam still rising off the dish of mussels, and thought, "He's really quite a kid, even though he's 11 years older than me." That was the attractive thing about him, this childlike quality in a brilliant young professor, although at this moment it was annoying. "Atlanta can wait," she said firmly. "This is my favorite aunt we're talking about." "You were going to go in the summer." "Didn't you hear what I said? The place is closing ahead of schedule. I have to get her things." It hit her again that her Aunt Rima was dead, had been dead for more than a year, that there was no relief from the shock of it, no matter how many times she mourned. And Chester was being a jerk right now. And she had homework to finish, grad school being what it was. She got up, grabbed her bag, and turned and walked away from him, from his shocked face, his half-suppressed, "Varsha!" The catcalls and laughter from the men at the bar. At the door, she looked back very briefly. He was rising to his feet, arms reaching out, his face filled with rage and bewilderment. The night outside was cold. She fell into her familiar jogging rhythm, ignoring the glances of strangers, feet pounding on the pavement, bag strapped tight across her chest, all the way to the tea station at the corner. The tragically delayed letter was lying on her desk. I'm coming," she said silently to Rima, "just like you wanted me to a year ago. I'm coming to Alaska for spring break." I first heard the songs of the bowhead whale on the internet. Varsha and I and a bunch of neighborhood kids and one of the pariah dogs, I think it was Tinku, were gathered in front of the veranda of the Patna house, playing a video game. For some reason that I can't remember now, we looked up whale songs, and there it was, the long, strange call filling the space. The dog Tinku started howling in tandem and wagging his tail, as though he could understand what the whale was saying. All of us burst out laughing. But there was something about that song that tugged at me. It occurs to me now that my journey to the Arctic started there, on that afternoon, with the honeysuckle bush in full bloom and the smell of the flowers almost making me dizzy. The shisham trees in the front garden whispered in the breeze, a kind of bass note to the whale song. And all those years later, it is the whales I hear, and the shisham trees are a warm and distant memory. We are out in the boat, Jimmy and I, and we are following a pod of bowhead. There is an AUV, an underwater robot, fitted with a hydrophone that is moving with the whales. We can see its output right here on Jimmy's laptop, the spectral analysis of the conversation below, and the sounds themselves and their immense complexity. We know each individual in the pod. They were tagged decades ago. But even without the tags, the coloring on their flukes or the injury scars on their flanks tell us who they are. We're seeing more propeller scars since the Arctic was open to shipping. The killer whales have been moving up too, hungry terrors that they are, and the bowheads that survive bear some horrifying scars. No wonder the bowheads are pushing farther north, toward the pole, where the waters are still cold, tracking the changing currents in search of krill. I have learned that bowheads may be the oldest living animals in the world. They live for over 200 years. Apart from the new threats, their lives are relatively peaceful. The slow migrations around the North Pole in the sub-freezing waters with their kin. When hungry, they just open their enormous garage-sized mouths and sieve in millions of tiny krill. Living that long, they must think long, deep thoughts. What do they think about? What do they say to each other? When we are back at North Point, Jimmy will put on the headphones and scroll through the video feed and spectral analysis. Apart from language recognition software, he says immersive attention is a way to use the best pattern recognition device we know, the brain. It's what his people have always done. Paid attention to their environment in a way that makes the most observant scientists among us seem oblivious, blind, bumbling. No wonder I'm having such a hard time with the language. Inupiaq has to be the most precise language in the world. I wish I could help you all understand what it is about this place that gets me. It is so cold I don't have the words to describe it. Even with global climate change, even with the warming of the Arctic, the winters here are colder than we tropical flowers can ever imagine. When the wind blows, which it does all the time in gales and gasps, I feel like there is no breath in my lungs. I have to put warm gel packs in my gloves and boots so that I don't get frostbite. For 6 months of the year, there is darkness or near darkness, and what I miss the most, there are no trees. But still, this place draws me and draws me and draws me, and it isn't just Jimmy or the work. The tundra in early spring is astounding. The way the low sun hits the snow, the blinding beauty of it takes the breath away. Once, out in the field, we saw two Arctic foxes playing, chasing each other round and round in circles without a sound. But the tundra is not silent. Did you know ice can speak? It squeaks and grunts, makes little slithering, sliding noises and great explosive cracking sounds, too. Once, early in my stay here, we were out on the sea ice, Jimmy and I, along with a few others from North Point. It was dark and cold, but very still. The stars were out in their billions, and we could see the faint, translucent curtains of the northern lights high in the sky. We were getting ready to set up our instruments, talking quietly, when Jimmy said, "Guys, we've got to get off. Now." I looked around, but there was no obvious threat. I was going to ask Jimmy what the problem was, but then I saw everyone else acquiesce without argument. They packed up in a big hurry, too. "Hurry, hurry," Jimmy kept saying. I was thinking maybe there was an emergency with his family that he'd somehow remembered, but the moment we got off the ice, there was an ear-splitting crack, and the segment we had been on suddenly broke off. You can't imagine what that was like. A whole great peninsula of floating ice suddenly detached from the rest of the shore ice and floated away, ghost-like in the semi-dark, into the black Arctic Ocean. I was shivering and shaking with shock, but the others were slapping Jimmy on the back and shaking his hand as we trudged back to the trucks. I asked him later how he knew. "It's paying attention." Something he learned from his father and grandfather when he went hunting with them as a little boy. A kind of sixth sense that is developed through experience, a sensitivity to the slightest change in wind direction, the tiniest syllables spoken by the ice, imperceptible to others. This ability to communicate with the physical environment is what originally earned the respect of scientists for native elders. In the plane, on the final leg of the journey, Varsha's bravado vanished. It was a really small plane, and there was a crack across the plastic of the seat in front of her, which didn't inspire confidence. She could pull on her augs and edit that all the way, but she wasn't such a V-head. Working in the field, you got to know where to draw the line. It didn't help that there was sick misery rising in her. There was no avoiding the fact of Rima's death. Rima was supposed to have come down from Alaska to settle her in last August when Varsha had first arrived from Delhi. But she was already 7 months dead and gone, taken by the ice during a storm, along with her partner and lover, an Eskimo scientist called James Young. It had been hard enough for Varsha to alight in Boston alone, to find her way to the International Graduate Student's Office at the university, to walk the bewildering streets of Cambridge in search of her apartment. But this was harder. The man who had forwarded Rima's last letter had written to say that the research facility where her aunt had worked was closing down ahead of schedule, and there were some things of Rima's that the family might like to have. The man's name was Vincent Jones, and he would be glad to help in any way he could. The plane banked. They were about to land in Utqiagvik. Her aunt had always, in her restless travels, been drawn to remote places, but this was the end of the world, or so it had seemed from the pictures on the internet, a town of mostly Eskimo people at the edge of the Arctic Ocean. She pressed her face against the window. There was a whiteness everywhere. White sky, white land, no horizon but the undifferentiated whiteness. For a moment, she thought they must be flying through clouds, but the plane's wing was clearly visible. She fought a feeling of wild panic and reasoned with herself. The plane wasn't going to crash. There were people talking all around her, tourists and natives, excitedly, because this was the first real winter in a decade. Which hotel? That must be new. They say the Castle of Light has the best views. Worst winter they've had in a decade. This is a real winter. This is what winters used to be like, back then, before the Great Melt. It will be good, maybe, for the whaling. The sea ice came back this winter to nearly 70%. No more multi-year ice. It will be thin and dangerous to walk on. When you were growing up, every year like this? Man, that must have been crazy. In the whiteness below, there appeared a pinprick, then another and another. A line of houses or sheds all in a row. The plane swooped lower and lower, and she held on to the edge of her seat, thinking this was what Rima had seen on her first visit to this place. When was it? 5 years ago? Maybe she'd been in this very plane, in the same seat. The misery rose in her like a solid wall. On the ground, there was ice everywhere. The runway was ice, and ice rimmed the edges of the small airport. It was a large metal shed with a corrugated roof and an extension clearly under construction. Behind it were roads of ice and buildings in the same utilitarian style. The airport was a single large hall with areas sectioned off for tickets, departures, arrivals, and luggage. Native Inupiaq Eskimos, white tourists, a small knot of men in Coast Guard uniforms. How strange to be in a place where the whites were so clearly the other. And yet this was still America. Oh, America, I thought I knew you. She heard English around her in a language she took to be Inupiaq, the native tongue of peoples who had been here for thousands of years before the Europeans came. What would Rima have thought and felt coming here for the first time? Waiting for her suitcase, she texted the family group. I'm here in Utqiagvik. All fine. I must only be the second Indian to come to this place. It's really different. There was her little orange suitcase between wooden boxes and sacks. She hauled it off the belt and looked around with a feeling of panic. Where was her host? Her augs beeped and she hastily pulled them on. The scene before her was augmented with scrolling information and a couple of V-Real polar bears, wearing toothy, welcoming smiles, were speaking a welcome. Welcome to Utqiagvik, northernmost city in the U.S., they said. Take your taxi or van directly from the airport area. Polar bears have been sighted in town. Amidst the strangeness and wonder of this was the little message icon flashing, showing her an outline of where Vincent Jones was waiting for her. Near the exit door, she arranged her backpack on her shoulders and wheeled her suitcase ahead of her to the exit. He was a large man with a broad, quiet face. His thin hair was streaked with white. He looked like the Tibetan refugee she had known in New Delhi. Smiling, he held out his hand. Good, good, you're here. Rima talks so much about you. You look like her. Thanks for receiving me, she said. It was so strange to be here without her Aunt Rima, who would have stood here shivering like this in this exact spot. There was a wind blowing, sharp in her face like icicles. She pulled up her hood. Vincent seemed unperturbed by the wind. They climbed into a large black Land Rover, which lumbered slowly into the streets of ice. It's a little ways to North Point, Vincent said. We'll go through Utqiagvik and by the ocean, so you can see the sea ice over the Arctic. It's been some years since we've had a winter like this one. Used to be the norm once upon a time. All she knew about Vincent was that he was somebody at North Point Polar Research Station, and he had been Rima's friend, and he had sent the letter. It had been found on the desk in her office. He had been going through her desk because North Point was closing down. Rima must have meant to send it right before the trip out to sea, from which she had never returned. What was it like last winter when my aunt died? She said. Might as well get it over with. We got the reports, but I'd like to understand. It wasn't this cold or icy, he said, but we did get one great storm. The Arctic has been in a warming trend for decades, but it's not steady. It goes up and down. Last winter, the sea ice was so thin you couldn't walk on it. Things are changing so fast weather-wise, it's hard to predict whether a storm is going to fizzle out or turn into a howling blizzard. Rima and Jimmy were out in one of the research boats, less than 10 miles from shore when the blizzard hit. Her hands clenched on her lap. It was cold despite the heater. The tips of her fingers felt like ice. We didn't used to have much of a Coast Guard presence when I was growing up, Vincent was saying. But even with a Coast Guard station right here, they couldn't do anything with that storm. Had to wait 2 days before they could risk sending out the helicopters and the search vessels. That was the only bad storm we had that winter. This winter, the cold and snow and ice are much more steady. This was normal once. He cleared his throat. Jimmy was my cousin. Oh, God, I'm so sorry, she said. She glanced at him. He was looking straight ahead, his face set. She looked out of the window. There were children out on bicycles. Bicycles with thick treads in the front of a small grocery store. Their parka hoods were lined with fur. An Eskimo couple went by on a four-wheeled open vehicle, their faces ringed with fur-lined hoods. A man was digging out a car from several feet of snow in front of a house. The buildings had the same utilitarian steel shed look of the airport, except for an extraordinary structure some 6 floors high that looked like a wedding cake. Castle of Light Hotel, declared the ornate sign. Tourist trap, Vincent said, a short, amused laugh. Good for the economy, or so I hope. Used to be we'd make money off oil leases before the oil fields gave up the last of the oil. They turned east, leaving behind the houses. Now they were driving into the tundra. Ahead and to their right was an expanse of snowy whiteness, flat and featureless. After a while, they passed a large sign on their left with a cutout image of a larger-than-life snowy owl. Pogliavsky, declared the sign, standing alone in the snowy emptiness. Ukpiavik, site of an ancient Eskimo village, Vincent said. Behind the sign, the ground rose gently and then fell away into an enormous plain, its smoothness broken only by untidy chunks of ice, like broken pie crust. You should know, Vincent said after a while. Your aunt, she loved what she did. Like Jimmy, they were a pair. We're stopping a bit so you can see the sea ice. I'm sorry I didn't get to know him, Varsha said. She talked about him to us. She thought of Rima's full-on zest for life. It was possible to be a 15-year-old and feel older and duller than her then 30-year-old aunt. Those days, Rima's enthusiasms and adventures had led her from a short stint as an adventure and travel writer to a degree in mechanical engineering and the design and customization of wind generators in the high Himalayas. In the lush back garden of the old house in Patna, under the mango tree as old as her great-grandfather, Varsha had sat on the swing with Rima and heard all about the great expanse of the Tibetan desert, the lakes of meltwater from the vanished glaciers, oases in the arid heights. The wind that blew hard and cold, the measuring instruments that recorded wind speed and direction over an entire year, so that Rima and her team could design the best wind energy capture system for that particular locale. She saw the pictures and felt the possibilities of the world open up, a familiar side effect of being with Rima. And now there was a lump in her throat. But Vincent was already pulling over by the side of the road and motioning her to get down. Here she was, Varsha of the tropics, on the Alaskan North Shore. There was the endless white expanse before her, with only the shiny ice road winding away before them. The sun had emerged from the clouds and lay low on the horizon. The light on the snow hurt her eyes. She pulled up her augs in world mode. You are 1,280 miles from the North Pole, scrolled the message to the right of her field of view. Vincent led her to the top of the rise on the left. Her boots crunched on the snow. At the top, they paused. Before them was the great white plain, broken by small piles of cracked ice. It extended all the way to the horizon, as far as she could tell. That's the Arctic Ocean, Vincent said. Sea ice, frozen seawater. You can tell there's water under there from the way the currents make the ice break up. Can you walk on it? In places. Used to be parts of the sea ice attached to the shore stayed all year round, built up a little every season, as much as 3-4 meters thick sometimes. We used to camp on the ice when we cut whaling trails in the spring. Your aunt ever tell you about that?
A little, Varsha said.
She said the whaling hadn't been very good for a while. You're cold. Let's get back in the car. Yes, the bowheads changed their migration patterns after the big melt. We, the Inupiaq, my people, had always lived with the whales, and when they started to change, our old knowledge wasn't as much help. The killer whales started coming up into the warming waters, hunting the bowheads, and the T-Rexes became active at the time. In the car, the heater was running on high. She put her hands in front of the vents. We'll get you proper gear for this place, he said. Your aunt's stuff.
She loved this place, but never liked the cold. She nodded.
Tell me about the T-Rexes, she said. There was an augury experience involving intelligent monster machines that she'd helped debug when it was still in production. She'd been surprised to learn that T-Rexes were for real in the world.
There are about 20 of them working these waters, he said. Still got oil and methane down on the sea floor. T-Rexes found 2 large deposits last year. But they're having trouble with some of them, I hear. Shutdowns and failures. Keep your eyes peeled. We may see one on the way. There's one operating a few miles from us at North Point.
They didn't see any T-Rexes, but after about an hour, the North Point Research Facility loomed suddenly out of the landscape, a building capped by 4 tall steel lattice towers and 3 rows of small windows on the visible sides of a cubicle structure in between. The windows shone in the sun's low light. The place was larger than she expected. It jutted out into the plain of sea ice on concrete pillars.
We're down to a handful of people, Vincent said, leading her in past a heavy steel door. Most of the researchers have left. The rest are packing up, finishing up. You'll meet them at meals. I'm the native liaison here.
Inside, there were white walls and long corridors, gray-painted metal doors, some with windows.
Who's bought the station?
Gaia Corp's Arctic Energy Unit, he said.
They run the T-Rexes.
The dorms were at the back of the facility. Their footsteps echoed emptily in the silence. Lights came on as they walked. Vincent led her to a small room with a white bed and a desk and chair.
Bathrooms down the hall, he said. Sorry, we live kind of plain here.
Why don't you get settled and I'll ping you when it's time for dinner? The door next to yours, that's the suite Rima and Jimmy had. It has an attached bathroom if you want.
Here's their key card and here's yours.
Thought it would be easier to have you right next door. After she had washed up and unpacked, she saw that it was only 4:30. She took a deep breath.
Might as well start now.
She went into the suite her aunt had shared with Jimmy Young. It consisted of a tiny outer room and a bedroom and bathroom. When she turned on the light, she was startled at how bare it looked. It had clearly been used very little, mostly for sleeping, she imagined. There was a stereo in the small living room, a carving of a polar bear on the coffee table that looked like it had been made from bone, and a picture of 2 people on the prow of a boat. She picked up the photograph. It was Rima, her face rimmed by a fur hood, and almost uncle, Jimmy. Snow goggles pushed back over his head, his dark hair windswept. They were both grinning as though they were having the time of their lives. She set it down again, congratulating herself for keeping her composure so far. She had a job to do, and she simply had to keep herself together until it was done. Pretend she was on an errand for a strict taskmaster like her aunt. Yes, sure. In the bedroom, she willed herself to open the closet. Vincent had taken care of Jimmy's things. Only her aunt's clothes were here. She could donate some to the local town swap, Vincent had said. She breathed the still air inside the closet. Was there something of Rima left here, still, after all these months? A faint whiff of something indefinable. A lotion, yes. The sandalwood lotion from home that everyone in the family used. There was a long beaded kurta in green and a pink chaikan work outfit among the flannel shirts and turtlenecks. She buried her face in the kurta and swallowed a lump in her throat. She would keep those. She began to pull things onto the bed, making 2 piles.
Once she had begun, it was easy enough to continue with the suitcases in the closet, mostly empty, and the shoes at the bottom. Then the side table. This was going fast. If she went through the office stuff as quickly, she would be done in a day. Whatever had possessed her to plan a 4-day stay? But when Vincent knocked on the door to call her to dinner, there was still the pile on the bed to be arranged, and the books in the bookshelf. She had let herself become distracted by them. Well-thumbed volumes about Inupiaq culture and history. One on biomimicry, a number of technical-looking books on alternative energy and acoustical engineering. There was a book she had gifted to her aunt when Rima had left for the U.S., The Best Travel Writing of the 21st Century. It had Love, Varsha on the inside cover. There were books on economics and history, cetacean biology, and interspecies communication. She was relieved to go down to the dining hall where a buffet meal was served, rolls and fried chicken and some kind of vegetable greens she couldn't identify. She sat with Vincent and 4 other people to whom she was introduced, all white except for Vincent and an African-American called Kenny, who was a sea ice expert. It was strange to be around people who weren't wearing AUGs or any other kind of goggles, who were so much in the world. Usually she liked talking to people, but suddenly she was almost too exhausted to eat. Fortunately, the others seemed preoccupied with the impending shutting down of the Institute. Incomprehensible discussions about local politics and who was going where and what Arctic energy would do with the facility allowed her to concentrate on her food and sit with her thoughts, until the woman with the salt and pepper hair sitting next to her said in a low voice, "Sorry about your aunt. It must be awful. But you don't want to talk about that. How was your trip?" She would have liked to talk about Rima. It might have helped her feel grounded, she thought tiredly. But she had noticed how most Americans tended to assume that dead people were off topic. She tried to smile. "Long and cold, at least the drive here. I'm still warming up." The woman laughed. Her name was, yes, Julie. She had very pale skin and a fine dusting of freckles. "I've been here for 2 years, and I'm not really used to being here either. For one thing, the Arctic is going through some really rapid changes, kind of like being married to what's-your-name here." She elbowed the man next to her, who smiled. "But mostly what gets me is the absence of light for 6 months of the year. If you'd come in December, it would have been darker and colder. Boston will feel tropical after this." "Hey," Vincent said, "this is the best place in the world, even with climate change. No need to enhance reality when you have this." He swept his arm around the room. The Arctic night was dark blue outside the small square windows. "It would be hard to edit out the cold, or your ass freezing doing field work on the ice," said one of the young men whose name she had forgotten already. He nodded pleasantly at her. "Vince, said you're in V-reality, is that right?" "Not at the moment," she said. The greens tasted bitter and sad, as though they had never known the sun. Even her AUGs couldn't fix that. She explained about her master's program. "Bet you can't wait to get out of here," said the young man. "The U.S. of A. isn't what it used to be. Unbelievable how quickly things have changed in just a few years." "It wasn't that great before, Matt," said the black man. Varsha remembered his name was Kenny or something. "Yes, Kendrick." He looked in disgust at the pile of chicken bones on his plate and stabbed at the soggy greens with his fork. "Yes," he said. "Try being black in America and in any era. It's worse now, of course. And there's North Point. There was a time we couldn't have imagined oil coming back after the ban. Now we have Gaia Corp, promising to protect us through geoengineering. Project Terra. Why study climate change when we can fix it from space? We can burn fossil fuels again, get the last of the oil and gas out of the Arctic. 5-6 years ago, if you told me that, there would be T-Rexes in the ocean and North Point bought out by Gaia Corp, I would have said you were crazy. I'll never say it can't happen again. Started with the Space Act in 2015, said Matt. You start mining the moon, and then suddenly you have the corporate wars. Then Earth Corp, and the agreements with nations, and spare me the history lesson, said the fourth person, the one next to Julie. He put down his fork and dragged his fingers through long, straggly brown hair. I agree with you in broad terms, but you are connecting the wrong dots, Matt. Vincent pushed back his chair. Gotta go finish up some things, Varsha. You got everything you need? Breakfast is from 6 to 9 a.m. After breakfast, if you want, Julie can show you around. Julie? Sure, Julie said. Varsha felt guilty. These people were winding down what seemed to be their life's work. She didn't need showing around. She had all the sorting and packing to do. But she really wanted to know Rima, the polar scientist. She wanted to know her almost Uncle Jimmy. She nodded. Thanks. I'd love that, if it isn't too much trouble. There was a T-Rex at work far on the horizon. She was looking out of the window of the office her Aunt Rima had shared with Jimmy Young. Jimmy's space had been cleared, and someone called Tara Longfield now occupied it, her absence bounded by pictures of a smiling blonde child and drawings in crayon. But Rima's desk was stacked with boxes of her things, papers, books, knickknacks that had used to be on her desk, including a picture of Varsha and another picture of the family at the Patna house. The colors faded, but the faces still poignant in their familiarity. Varsha was the kid tugging at Rima's arm in the picture, pointing off camera to something in the garden, and Rima was bent slightly forward, laughing, about to follow her niece's glance. They were the only two not looking at the camera. It was cold in the empty office. She looked up to the window and saw the skyscape. The morning sun still low in the sky, the impossible immensity of the expanse of snow, the pale gray smudge of the horizon. And against it, a T-Rex somewhere far ahead where the sea ice gave way to open sea. Its skeletal frame, with the long head turning slowly this way and that, looked so alive and purposeful that she shuddered involuntarily. They were smart machines, she knew, but this one, far away as it was, seemed positively sentient. Its long labrum sipped hydrocarbons off the ocean floor, and the proboscis sniffed for methane bubbling up off the ocean floor. When exploring, she had heard it would become buoyant in the water, its array of air guns firing boom-boom into the sea, looking for oil and gas under the sea floor. It was an amazing piece of engineering. Despite the remoteness of this one, it felt more real than the one she had seen in VR games. A knock at the door made her jump. Without waiting for her response, a man came in. He was wearing a suit, which seemed incongruous after the casual clothing of the others. He was tall, with a pleasant open face and wavy dark brown hair. He wore a pair of Augs, state-of-the-art, in world mode. She could see his eyes through them. Green. He smiled and held out his hand. Rick Walters, so pleased to meet you, though in such sad circumstances. I knew your aunt well. There was something compelling about him, she noticed, as she returned the pressure of his hand, an air of complete assurance and good nature. I just wanted to let you know, if you need help or want to talk, I'll be in and out, he said. Thanks. Are you a scientist here? He laughed. Me? Alas, I haven't the temperament. I'm the transition liaison, making sure the handover goes smoothly. Much as I'd prefer an AUG's enhancement, I have to have results in the world, sorry to say. She laughed. I'm glad you're not a V-head. It gives us a bad name. I just got my nephew his first real AUGs, Rick said lightly. He'll be totally thrilled to know I met someone who works with them. He passed his hand over the edge of her aunt's desk, picked up the family photo, and set it down. Sorry, I shouldn't be interrupting. Later, after he'd left, she thought how normal he seemed. He was from her world, the world of busy metropolises and high tech. But there was an older world than that, and she missed it now. Standing in the cold room, she pulled on her AUGs and brought up her favorite program for when she was homesick. The walls of the room turned to sunlight yellow, and the view from the window was of her grandparents' courtyard. There was the old guava tree that she had grown up with. There were potted plants on the bench beside the window, and she could hear the faint strains of the tanpura from her music lesson in the next room. The program was creative. It took the boxes of her aunt's stuff on the desk and rendered them into piles of multicolored knitting wool. Her grandmother was a knitter. Someone came into the room. It was her uncle. She waved to him, smiling. But when he spoke, his voice was distorted. We apologize for the cognitive dissonance. The words scrolled across her field of view. Initiating patch. But she had already pulled the AUGs down. It wasn't her uncle speaking Hindi. It was Vincent speaking English. His thin gray hair was disheveled, as though he had just pulled off his hat coming in from the cold. Sorry, she said, but he was asking her something. Was Rick Walters just here? Yes, he said he was a friend of my aunt's. He offered to help. He's no friend of Rima's, Vince frowned. Rima hated his guts. He was on the original negotiating team for North Point. She fought hard against the buyout. He's here to make sure everything's accounted for. I came to warn you not to tell him anything. He stops by without warning, acts real friendly. He nodded at her and left. In the cold and the silence, Varsha shivered. I don't know what's what, she told herself. There was no signal on her phone. The last text she had got from the family was a be careful out there from her grandfather, and similar notes from her parents, her cousin Sanjay, and her AUG's friends group. Her mother and father were fighting again, and Biru's uncle was in Patna because Nanu was having a medical checkup. Chester had sent about 20 pings already, which she had ignored. She didn't feel like resuming the AUG's program or sifting through her aunt's things. She sat down at the desk and put her head in her hands and remembered. For the longest time, she had shared a room with Rima, her mother's youngest sister, every visit to Patna. They decorated the room with strange structures. There were wires suspended across the room with wheeled carts that ran up and down, a plastic monkey in a bucket that jumped out and woke them up at 7 a.m. every morning. Anyone approaching the room, no matter how quietly, would be anticipated, thanks to an IR sensor that beeped a warning in Swedish. She and Rima used to invent games for the little ones. The one she was thinking of now was a winter game. They would drag a couple of rosaies down to the carpet to make a huge multicolored mountain, and they would hide under sections of the thick folds while the little cousins would screech excitedly and try to find them, their fat, slippery bodies like so many wriggling fish on the satin covers. The rosaies were thick enough that the mountain stood without help. and they would roll the ping pong ball collection down from the summit, one by one, trying to guess at first where, among the folds and channels, valleys and crinkles, the balls would end up. It was sometimes tricky because you'd think the pink ball would slide just so into the long, straight channel leading all the way to the bottom of the mountain. But a little crinkle here, or a little subtle encouragement there, from an aunt half concealed within the folds, would send the ball careening to quite another destination. This is where Varsha learned about chance, and how a small and sudden change could lead you to quite another path.